Monday, January 25th, 2010. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with Al Crane, retired Fish and Wildlife Service Special Agent from Alaska. We'll talk about his many adventures working on wildlife law enforcement in the state, his work as one of the early organizers of the 1,100-mile Iditarod dog sled race, and how that experience helped him connect with Native Alaskans to do his job better. But first, let me repeat some of the creature calls from the Wildlife's first creature call contest. Last week, I played a series of 10 creature calls and gave listeners of both the radio show and podcast 4 weeks, until February 15th, to email me their guesses. The person who guesses the most creature calls correctly and contacts me first will win a copy of my book, Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. It's sort of a wildlife CSI, and it was published by Scribner. If you're interested in entering, you can get detailed hints on these and the rest of the calls by listening to the January 18th podcast of the show. You can download this and other podcasts of The Wildlife at iTunes, my website, laurelnemi.com, or at laurelnemi.podbean.com. Now, here is creature call number one from the contest, which is the sound made by a marine mammal that lives in the Arctic and is known as a sea canary. Now, let me turn to my conversation on wildlife law enforcement with Al Crane. I first talked with Al Crane in 2003 when I started researching walrus poaching cases in Alaska for my book, Animal Investigators. Mr. Crane was a special agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and was the first such officer to be stationed in Northwest Alaska. He'd been hired away from Alaska's Fish and Wildlife Protection Division in 1974 to implement the newly passed Federal Marine Mammal Protection Act. For the next 20-plus years, he acted as supervisor, pilot, and field operative for federal wildlife law enforcement. As we talked over the years, and as I visited many of the places he'd worked, I gained an appreciation for the difficulties of working in this rugged terrain, and also for the importance of convincing local people of the validity of wildlife protection laws in order to get their compliance. Crane's more than 30 years as a wildlife law enforcement officer in Alaska, a bush pilot, and a devoted outdoorsman gave him a well-deserved reputation for approachability, fairness, and understanding of Native culture. He was also one of the early organizers of the Iditarod and ran that grueling race in 1977. These actions not only reinforced his credibility and toughness, but helped him connect with Native Alaskans in a way that would help him do his job. When we talked last week, I asked Al to relate how he first got into wildlife law enforcement.
I've always been kind of a country boy. I was raised in the West on the Utah-Idaho-Wyoming border up in near the Tetons. And so it just came naturally to be involved in hunting and fishing and those sorts of outdoorsy things. I was, like, being raised on a ranch, we were always among the outdoors, wildlife, fish stuff. And even though I went away to get educated as a school teacher, I always was in love with that end of things.
So how did you go from being educated as a school teacher to wildlife law enforcement?
Well, it was kind of a fluke in a way. I had gone to Alaska to teach school with my wife, and we had contracts in Petersburg, Alaska, and it was in the late 60s, and we were driving up, and when we called to Petersburg to make sure they had gotten our contracts, they told us the contracts had never arrived, and they had given it to someone else. And she was to teach English, and I was to teach political science and biology and history.
So what did you do?
And so there we were, needing a job.
And where was this town? Was it near Anchorage?
No, Petersburg is in the southeast panhandle, below Juneau. It's some of the most beautiful part of Alaska. And I had been going there in the summers as a temporary.
What's that?
like a lot of folks do, they go to work in canneries and they go to work in different places on fishing boats. And I had worked as a temporary for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I ended up being the expediter for all the food and flew around to service all the crews that were out in the bush with to keep them supplied while they were doing their job. So those were wonderful summers, and I did work in the canneries a little and on fishing boats a little, but that kind of got me in Alaska. And then, of course, when we decided to teach school, that was going to be our home, and I had convinced my wife of it early on, so we were on our way to do that.
So when you got there and they didn't have your contract, what did you do?
I knew enough people by then that I thought, well, if all else fails, maybe I can go back to this business of wildlife, fish and wildlife protection. And we drove on to Anchorage, and I had the opportunity to work in the oil fields on rigs or to paint buildings. I called Juno and asked if they had something in this department, and lo and behold, I got a temporary job and eventually a permanent job and in Ketchikan and Juno and in the protection end of it. So I worked for the state for, I think it was a total of 9 years, but 6 full years. And during that period, I ended up being the Juno district officer. And
what did you do as a district officer in Juneau for the Fish and Game Department?
Well, those jobs were more like the state game warden jobs, because you were enforcing Alaska state law. You know, during deer season, it was deer hunting laws, and it was during fishing, it was fishing laws. I got a lot of experience as a state officer right there in Southeast Alaska.
And what were some of the biggest issues in that part of Alaska? Were they fishing related?
Most of the serious problems were commercial and commercial oriented. And I felt in my mind much more like it was also much more of a serious thing if hundreds of thousands of dollars were at stake, or if people could, say, rob a bay of fishing in a night and pay for their fishing boat. Not only did they pay for the fishing boat, they also destroyed a run of salmon.
Now, as part of your job, you learned to fly there, yeah?
When I would go out and do my job as an officer, sometimes with the local flying services, I would take the wheel and learn all there was to learn about flying.
Now, did you stay in that region?
Eventually, I was transferred to Bristol Bay, which is the salmon capital of Alaska. Some of the largest salmon runs in the world, and I was the district officer at Dillingham and had my own Super Cub on floats and the responsibility of enforcing that fishery on the Nishigak River and all around the coastlines north and south of there.
So take me on one of the cases that you had involving some fisheries and describe, because I think I don't even have a concept of how remote these places are and how.
Well, those were, yes, I understand what you're saying, but those are some years back, but those were wonderful experiences because we like to say those were in the the Wild West days. It was the times that if commercial boat would come in to sea into a bay which had been marked by the Fish and Game Department as closed to a certain point from the stream. And because the fish congregated in those areas close to the streams, and before they would go up the freshwater to spawn. And so if you came in past behind those lines and you made a set, it's possible to have made enough money in that one set and pull those fish back over the line or to a legal area to make a healthy payment on your fishing boat or to pay for your fishing boat or to retire. And so we did have several cases where, and in those days, funding was not, Alaska wasn't well-heeled. They didn't have a lot of money. In fact, there was lots of federal subsidies, but in those days.
And this was in the late 60s?
That's the late 60s.
Okay.
And they had a program where they would hire college students or young people to basically camp undercover and watch these streams. And you'd do it randomly so that the fishing boats never knew where you were. So if a fishing boat decided they were going to take the fish out of a particular bay, and there were bays that were more vulnerable than others, and so it might be that a little boat would come in, and they would all the seine crew, which was five or six people on a seine boat, a purse seine boat, and that's a boat that would come in and make a big net loop around the fish, draw and pull it together, and then draw the bottom together like you would a purse, a sack. Hmm. And then you would have all these fish in there. Well, they would come in and stand on the bow or the side of their boat and shoot their rifles at the beaches to see if there was anybody around and scare everybody to death that might be trying to protect it, and then they'd proceed. And so those were the circumstances in which we'd find ourselves a lot. And then
so
the guys
would you
that...
do if people are shooting rifles just to...
You would hide, and you never know. They would never know that you were there until the last minute, and if they started to do it and you had to go out, there was a difference between shooting and not knowing whether you were in there or not and they hit you, or shooting you directly. So most of the time, you could come out, and what the technique was to get in a kayak while your partner was on the beach and kayak out to the big fishing boat, and your partner was covering you on the beach, and then you would crawl up on the fishing boat, write the citations or make the arrest, and then you would have them pick up your partner, and then you would head to the nearest town, which could be 8 hours away. And those, like I say, that sounds like Wild West, right?
It does sound like Wild West.
And we took many of those boats to town, and they paid their penalties in those days somewhere $5,000 to $10,000.
It was really dangerous.
They didn't want you to do it. If they were intent on killing you, of course, then that was a different story. But it's a big leap from shooting in the air or shooting up the cliffs or making it look like they were going to get you and actually pulling the trigger. And there seems to be only one known instance where Fish and Wildlife Temporary was killed, and I don't know much about that, but it happened before me. And they never found his body, and also they never found the perpetrators.
So most of the time, if folks were illegally taking some of these commercial fish stocks, and was it mostly salmon or other
most
species?
Always salmon.
Always salmon. And they would accept the penalty, pay the citation, and be done.
And yes, it was the cost of doing business. If they got caught, then that year they were $5,000 or $10,000 down. But the income was so great that you could take the chance.
So how much would you make from a haul like that? An illegal.
It would be easy to make $50,000 to $100,000.
So 5 to 10 was nothing compared.
Yes. And that's been the way of things in Alaska up until the 70s and 80s when I joined the federal people. That was the way of things with fines in Alaska. And now, of course, things are different. But it was like the same thing in Bristol Bay. You could make $150,000 in a summer. So if you had a couple of breaches with the authorities, $5,000 a whack, that was nothing.
When did you join, and why did you join the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service?
Well, I was in Dillingham, and my youngest son was small, and I was quite happy in Dillingham, but there were some things that were happening in Alaska with in politics connected to how fish and wildlife protection was being run, and it was at the time when one of the governors, in just a stroke of a pen, switched them from the Fish and Game Department under the Department of Public Safety, and they became Alaska State Troopers. Well, this took them from a realm of
what did that really mean? And on the ground?
Well, what that meant is it took us from a philosophy of, I thought at the time, of enforcement for biological reasons to enforcement for enforcement reasons. And then what that means is when a trooper is doing what is enforcing the law, he knew the details of law, and there's some good in this and some bad, but he knew the details of the law, and that if you broke the law, you broke the law. He did not have the background of the biological purposes of the law, and so I always thought that the judgment that you needed to enforce the law came from a lot of different areas, and part of it would have come from being educated in biology and in the reasons why that law was made, and the importance of that law would be you could use your judgment a little bit more on when and where and how you enforce the law. So there were some of those strained relationships at that time. So everybody was a little bit uneasy because of the politics. And I received a couple of telephone calls within 20 minutes of each other, one from National Marine Fisheries and one from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And I was quite amazed that somebody wanted me to go to work for, leave the state and go to work for them. And they both offered me great deals. One was in Kodiak, and one was to be in Nome and be involved in the northern part of Alaska.
And you took the one in Nome. And this would be the first time that Fish and Wildlife Service had an agent posted in northwest Alaska.
In some ways, I really did miss the state game warden type job, but in other ways, this was a broad window of opportunity, and so I did it, and I've never regretted it.
And you said something interesting about being able to use your judgment in when and where and how you enforce the law. And I wanted to ask you, why is that so important, especially in Alaska?
There are so many things that are different than the rest of the country or even Anchorage when it's out in the bush, especially with the native folks and people that are what I consider country or rural people. You may not get cited in Nome, for example, for not having the license plate on your truck. But in Anchorage, you wouldn't get by. What I'm saying about the difference is that in using your judgment in wildlife laws, there is a accepted standard in what should be enforced when you see the regulations and you see the statutes connected to federal law or state law. But you have to choose, especially with the level of education of people, what direction you're going to go and how hard you are on folks, and you also have to have a certain amount of education in order for them to know what you're about. If you come out with like gangbusters and begin to enforce the law on them and they've never heard of it, in my estimation, it's kind of a pretty tough deal.
So you spent a lot of time educating people about the law.
In fact, that was one of the things you were hired to do, because the Marine Mammal Protection Act had just been passed when you were hired by the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Is that right?
As a matter of fact, that was part of the rule. That was part of the job when I first went to Nome, and I had used that some of those techniques in Bristol Bay to inform people, because it was rural Alaska before we actually came down hard on them. And yes, that was. Some people might have said, as you said in your book, that I was probably might have been looked at as a social worker before an enforcement officer. But I had it in my mind, and so did Ray Tremblay, who I think is one of the finest and best law enforcement people that Alaska's ever seen. He was the one that hired me, and he had been there during territorial days. I think he kind of knew that he was looking for someone like Al Crane, who would go out there and he would do things a little like maybe Ray had done it, and that was, how could you go to St. Lawrence Island, or how could you go to Diomede or Shishmaref or any of these outlying places and come down like gangbusters with the law without educating people to the law?
So what did you do?
So I spent a lot of effort with radio messages and village meetings and trying to get commitments from village elders and different things to get people to on the same track and to obey the rules. In fact,
how did you do that specifically?
One of my programs was radio segments in three different dialects, the northern, southern, and St. Lawrence dialects, Eskimo dialects, to just to get an understanding. And I think it worked. I think it was a good thing.
Now, tell me about flying. You're a pilot and an agent. And that's really important just to get around in that part of Alaska, because there aren't really roads there.
Well, there are roads, but they go nowhere. And you know that. So you've been there.
So describe that.
You can drive out the road, but the road is a road to go out and catch a muskox. Or to, when we say catch one, to go out and kill one. Or go out and catch a caribou or a reindeer or to fish.
They don't really connect a village with the big city.
So flying is, for me, flying was a tool that did two things. It was therapy for this, I always like to tell people this, that flying is a stress reliever just because it's so grand of a thing to get up above everything at a reasonably low altitude and see it all from above. And provided, of course, you have no mishaps, which I was lucky enough to have not had. But then the other thing was, is it gets you to places quickly, and it gives you an overview so that when you do get on the ground, you've had a look at what's there. And it brings to mind the story of Sam White, who was the first flying game warden in Alaska. He asked the government to help him out with his flying because he'd gotten himself an airplane. And it used to take like days or months or weeks or months to do things on a dog team. And you might get only one contact in several weeks when you went out to get this guy. And you'd tell this guy, okay, you got to come into town now. After you get through trapping, I want you to be in town on May 1st for court. And, of course, the old trapper would come to town on May 1st. But it would take you a long time to go out there and do that. And Sam White saw the value of the airplane, and the government refused to pay for his airplane because they thought it was just a passing trivia.
Oh, really?
Yes. And eventually, of course, we went to airplanes. But that's how anyone who's interested in that aspect should look up or Google Sam White, and you'd have a wonderful story.
Oh, interesting. And it's really dangerous to be flying all over in the bush.
Well, yes, in a sense, it's a very safe thing, but in another sense, if they know you're the game warden, I have had friends who have fellow officers and fellow biologists who have had bullets in their wings. That's one aspect. Another aspect is the weather in Alaska. The weather in Alaska is very uncertain. And when I first went to Alaska and first learned to fly, you could take off from Fairbanks, and after a certain point, you were on your own. There were no navigational devices. You had your compass and your chart, and you were headed to Nome. There was a certain part of that trip that you never heard, saw, or knew exactly. Well, you knew where things were, but there was nobody to talk to.
No radio.
No radio, that's right. When I say no one to talk to, there was no radio, and so if something went wrong, you better have had a good flight plan, or you would have been one of those statistics where there are airplanes that were never found. In fact, there's a refuge on the east coast or the west coast of Alaska called the Clarence Road Refuge out by Bethel. That's a wildlife refuge, and Clarence Rhodes actually was missing in the Brooks Range for 21 years.
Really?
His airplane, and it was found during my tenure up there.
Wow. And then the landscape changes a lot as well, plus it's hard to land in the bush.
Well, yeah, if you're on floats and you're in lake country, you're fine. Or you're on big tires, like Super Cubs, or airplanes with big tires, then you can get down too. But there are places that are very difficult, and so you got to become a certain amount of a pretty good pilot in order to get the airplane down and up in one piece. Then when you get down, you got to make certain that it's worth the effort, so that you're successful to a degree with the reason you went down. Otherwise, and when I say down, landing, to do what you were going to do. And I mean, I've known of people, agents or fish and wildlife officers who landed and crashed the airplane and never ever made the case.
So tell me about some of your cases.
There have been a lot of cases and over the years, and what comes to mind is a particular case with Big Game Guide, where 20 bears were taken illegally in that one spring 30-day period. Actually, it was a 10-day period, but the season's a 30-day period. And we had knowledge that from undercover work that a lot of this activity was illegal.
How did you know that?
What I did is I employed the services of an agent who was a Mexican-American from the San Antonio area. But he developed a cover inside Mexico with contacts that he had, and then he came hunting with this guide as a foreign national. So,
often how did you identify that guide as
from either complaints or the fact that he was making over $500,000 a year off the resource? And we knew that from honest guides that to take three or four bears a year during that period and do them legally was almost impossible. How could you take 20 or 25? You had to be using your airplane and doing something illegal. It just so happens that hunting animals from the air is illegal under the Airborne Hunting Act, Federal Airborne Hunting Act, and also under state rules, too. And there are various other illegal things about that type of hunting, and there are rules about that when you kill those animals and you take them illegally in this country, and you transport them back to Mexico or back to Europe or wherever, those are Lacey Act violations or federal violations, because you took an animal in violation of state or federal law.
So what did you do? How did you get this guide?
I set an undercover hunt up, and my man actually went with this guide.
Was it dangerous?
In the camp were two Mexican nationals, which was strange because we didn't expect it. And they identified the Spanish as the wrong Spanish.
Oh, really?
So they were nervous. And so our guide flew into Kotzebue in northwest Alaska and called Mexico to verify the cover and did everything he could do and even threatened the hunter, who was an agent, who was in the back seat of his airplane, that he even threatened him that he was too old to go to jail and that he better not be a federal agent or such and such. And anyway, to make a long story short, they did land and kill a bear by driving it from the air. And then they... He was able to identify the spot where this bear was killed.
Meaning the agent was
by
able...
dropping some. I had him put a little remote radio there and drop a glove or two and do some things. And then I had to fly in there as the snow was melting in 65-degree weather amongst lava rocks, land there and do all the evidence gathering before it melted that day. And actually, one of the guys that went with me had to walk out of there because we couldn't get two people off the ground from that area during that time. I'd have had to got everything out of there with helicopter if we hadn't got out when we did.
And what time of year was it?
It was in late April.
And how deep was the snow? And there was
a lot of snow. Was that morning when I landed, the snow was just barely big enough. I could see the tracks on a drift between a big lava and grass on both sides of it. And I landed on that drift, and before I was through, I decided that I could only get me off there. I had to have the guy that was with me walk 15 miles out of there for me to pick him up in another place. So we eventually made the case.
And so what kind of evidence did you pick up there when you flew
okay,
back?
I picked up, first off, I was able to pick up the, take photos and pick up the evidence that the agent had dropped. Some personal items, and I had a little radio tracking device, so anyway, we pieced that together. I took the neck bone and some leg bones where we could place those together with the hide and put the on the skull, and do some lab work. And anyway, before it was over, we were able to determine that that was indeed the bear carcass that the hide came off of. And we eventually seized 20 bears nationwide from what I call VIP hunters from all over the world. There were two or three VIP hunters from this country. And before it was over, they kind of all fell like dominoes, and we made the case. And, of course, the guide lost his airplanes and paid a huge penalty. And at that point, there were no felonies involved. But within the next few years, he didn't seem to have learned his lesson, and so we did a major national sting on him with our folks from Washington, D.C., and then he lost his license, went to jail for a year, and paid $100,000+ fines.
And then is he still a guide now?
No, he became a born-again poacher, meaning that he went on national radio and television and became an advocate for doing things right. And I hope that that was sincere and that he eventually learned his lesson.
Can you tell me about some of the federal wolf cases that you've worked on?
I mean, there's been a lot of cases, but the wolf case in particular involved five wolves that were killed with the aid of an airplane.
So what happened?
I had a lead from a National Park Service agent who was flying down from the Brooks Range. He overheard a conversation about someone landing and putting an arrow in up a wolf's tail end, and those weren't the words used, and that they had gotten those wolves and that they had done other things. And anyway, it led me to do an investigation. And
how did you investigate that?
I was flying, in those days, I was flying a Cessna 185, and the snow was quite deep. It was north of Fairbanks. And I looked around for landing places in the area where that conversation came from. And I would land at every spot that I could see ski marks and do a walk around. And eventually I found some carcasses of wolves that had been skinned out.
What did you do then?
And so I gathered those wolves all up, five of them. And then I flew into the little town of Bettles.
So the carcasses were there?
Yeah, the carcasses were there, minus the hides. And anyway, it's kind of a simple thing, but it's not. It sounds simple maybe to someone who's listening to us, but this was a big, vast country, and 30 below zero, and deep snow, and you're out on skis landing in just places that are just, who knows what's underneath the snow. And anyway, then I went into Bettles, and I found a broken part of an arrow in a trash barrel next to the building where these people had slept. So I took all this back to Fairbanks, and I sent the wolves to Oregon to the lab.
And that's the National Fish and Wildlife Service.
Yes, in Ashland.
In Ashland, Oregon.
And I think this is one of the more interesting cases they've done, too, is that...
And this was in what year or around?
This was probably the late 80s. Okay. Anyway, they did some work on those wolves and x-rays, and by golly, there was the arrow right in the place that... And it matched the arrow from the trash can. And so there was a certain amount of circumstantial evidence there, but then various other little bits and pieces tied us together, and it was enough to indict these people.
Then what happened?
They fought us tooth and toenail, and I'm not going to mention much more about them because the guy turned out to be a nice guy in the sense, I'll tell you why, is that he fought me over and over and over. One was a guide, and one was a professional from Anchorage. And then we went to civil court, and it wasn't until the very last day, and he was basically found guilty, that he walked up to me, and he put his hand out, and he said, I really respect the fact that how you've done your job and how you've treated me. And he said, I thought that I was right because I thought the law had this loophole that allowed us to do what we did. And he says, and I understand what you did, and I feel very bad about it, and this is one of those times, I mean, for me, it was one of those times that I saw that a lot of these people are just thieves because they're robbing the public bank. But this guy was sure He loved to hunt. He loved to do these things, and he was sure that under the law he was legal, and it turned out he wasn't. And, of course, he changed his ways, and he hasn't become my best friend, but he's certainly become a supporter of resource law enforcement.
That's interesting.
Now, his guy, now the friend that he had, who talked about putting the arrow in the wrong place, he's never, ever forgiven me. But this guy was pretty, I thought that was a pretty good thing for somebody to do and to admit their wrongdoing.
And so has that happened frequently or infrequently where you come across people you've arrested previously? Is Alaska small enough that...
Yeah, it is. Over the years, I've received telephone calls or have met people that have... one was in particular that I feel really quite good about is a guy called me from a little village called Togiak out by Round Island.
Tell me a little bit about Round Island.
Round Island is a walrus sanctuary where only male walrus haul out, meaning they come ashore and rest. And they stay there for some, like a month or whatever, in certain times of the year. And that's been, it's a place where the state recognized its uniqueness, so they set it aside as a sanctuary. And for a number of years, the Eskimo people finally decided that that was okay, but then there would be a few diehards that would go into that sanctuary and in their skin boats and would take some of those walrus off there. And, of course, when you go ashore like that, the walrus just stampede off of the beaches, and then they often kill each other, and so there can be deaths of walrus just due to crushing. And if you're anywhere near all this when this happens, you can perish.
So tell me about the phone call you'd received from the person you had caught illegally walrus hunting on Round Island.
I probably wouldn't do today, but as a young agent who thought he could do anything in those days, I landed outside that island right in the surf and in the swells and next to that boat and did my job. And
they were in their skin boat, which is like a big 20-foot canoe.
Yeah, well, kind of like a canoe.
And you were... You
in a Beaver, De Havilland Beaver aircraft on floats.
Okay, and how did you get close to them without running into
them?
And
when their boat's going up, my boat's going down, my airplane's going down, and vice versa. And I took their names and did what you would do, could do, without... there was no possibility of an arrest. But there was, I did get the identifications, and then I took off, and this is sort of a miracle that all that took place without a mishap. But 30 years later, one of those guys in that boat called me.
Just out of the blue.
Out of the blue, and had been converted by that whole thing, and had followed the fact that he'd been treated. Well, followed me through my career and that he'd been treated fairly and evidently had been educated some way as to what he shouldn't do. So I had those sorts of experiences, and you were with me on St. Lawrence Island during the time you were doing your book when you heard from some of those folks. So I think all in all, the career was fairly rewarding.
What is your most... what accomplishment are you most proud of?
Well, I think the fact that in this business of enforcement, and I talk to a lot of enforcement people, it's like hunting. It's not the kill and seeing the animal laying there dead, it's the doing. So I'll correlate that to what I'm saying about enforcement. It wasn't the actual enforcement job of banging heads or handcuffing somebody or taking them to jail or watching them be diminished as a person because they were brought down. What it was implementing a standard of how things really should be done in this world and what was right and what was wrong. And I hope I'm articulating this the way that I want to, because when you and I went to St. Lawrence Island after all those years of controversy, 30 years, I thought, especially in the first years.
And I just want to back up for a minute. St. Lawrence Island is an island about 200 miles from the coast of Nome.
Yeah, it's about 200 miles.
And
it's very isolated.
And there's about two villages there with about 600 or so people in each. And
yes.
Only in the late 1990s did they get electricity there and running water. And they're just gravel islands. Very dangerous to fly there in a small plane, in fact.
Yeah, and here they are. They're living off the resource. It's their standard of it's their way to do things. And it's been done that way from time immemorial. However, just like I told them at one time at a village meeting, they had their crooks among them, just like everybody did. And when we went out there, when I first went there, it was just, I was telling you about these social programs. I mean, that for someone to tell them they could or couldn't do something on something they thought was their God-given right forever and have it regulated was really foreign to their thinking. But as time went along, after such cases as Operation Whiteout or cases where we most of the cases we made were either made for taking animals for resale for drugs or alcohol, or taking them, and in the long run that was probably the end, or the end result, but for taking them just to get the money off of what they could sell out of them, like, for example, the ivory. And in this cash economy, of course, they needed to buy oil, they needed to buy gas for their boats, they needed to buy food, so they would do whatever they would do to get this money.
Because it was legal for them to take the animal.
Because it was legal for them to take the animal, but it wasn't legal for them to make a wasteful take, meaning that they had to save meat and they had to save all of the useful items of a walrus in order to keep their privilege of hunting them. Well, we had program after program over the years and enforcement programs, all these different programs in order to try to educate these people to the value. There was always one or two in every village who saw the value of sustaining their lifestyle and their native culture and to doing things the way they were supposed to. But as they got, I guess you'd call it westernized, but as they become more like all of us, then there became more people who would do things as just to get the money. And so you had to have these programs. And so I often thought that I was kicking against the wall and that we were making no progress.
And then in 2005, you and I traveled all throughout that area while I was doing research for my book. And what did you find?
30 years later, after I had retired and after I had seen a lot of water run under the bridge, different agents had come and gone, and I was most gratified. And I thought received a certain validation in my job to go back to St. Lawrence Island and see that their own native corporations, their leaders, were now pushing the same principles and standards that we had tried to give them 30 years before, and that most of those things were being implemented, and that there were lots and lots of people who were following that standard. And that was it gave me a warm feeling inside to know. In fact, it was when I went with you there, I got almost more out of that than any other single thing, to go back and find that, hey, we did do something.
And the principles that you saw now really being held close were what?
Of not taking more than you could use, of being careful about what we called head hunting, just killing it for the ivory so you could sell it, about going back to the doing it the old way, and if you'd been given an exemption, as an exception to the Marine Mammal Protection Act, for example, by Congress, to to, everything's prohibited except for Alaska Natives, then you should honor that designation and not do anything that might take that exemption away from all of your neighbors.
And that exemption is nobody except Native Alaskans can hunt marine mammals.
That's right.
Provided that they do so for subsistence and not in a manner that's wasteful.
Exactly. Yeah, it was, and I really did get a lot of satisfaction out of the fact that people are, I thought, I could see a tremendous change in 30 years. And, of course, there would still be problems, but there now are professional posters made by their own people. There are now obviously people, their own people traveling among villages telling them to do things right. And that was pretty gratifying.
Why do you think you had such success in Alaska? What made people accept you?
You know, I've thought about that a lot, and recently I had someone say to me who is an attorney for the Bering Straits Native Corporation out of a place called Unalakleet. She's half Eskimo, and she looked at me one day and she said, "You're very well thought of in Northwest Alaska." And when you get a compliment like that, it's really gratifying. But I thought about it for a long time.
Especially in this culture, because people aren't very effusive and not very talkative.
That's right, and you don't know, Eskimo people especially, they'll smile, and they're kind of passive in a way, but they have, what's going on in their mind isn't what you see. And acceptance of outsiders, and sometimes even the Indian people or non-Eskimo people, and I was dealing mostly with Eskimos when I was in Nome, but Indians in Fairbanks. But I've thought about it a long time, and I think I had thought that it had to do something when you're doing the work. You need to break a rule that a lot of law enforcement people kind of adhere to, is that they are very careful, and they have to be, and I appreciate that, I understand it, but they kind of end up associating with their own because they're vulnerable, especially people who are undercover or in drug work or whatever. I mean, naturally, survival is means that you don't put yourself out into the wrong places.
Right.
I thought that maybe the key was, and the key thing would be, say, to live with the people. Live so that they, and do things, and be associate with them, so that they understand you. And there's a couple of reasons for this, is that they begin, if they see you as a person as they are, and they make some personal associations, sometimes they don't want to disappoint you if they know what you stand for.
Oh, interesting.
And I've thought about that a little bit, and I think that it's in Alaska, out where we were, that might be more so than maybe in a city where there's drug traffic and there's all these other problems. But
what did you do that helped people really get to know you and you them?
Some of the things I did was, and for my own purposes too, I had a dog team.
And dog sleds, tell me a little bit about dogs and dog sledding.
In the early years, of course, dog sledding and dog teams were an absolute necessity in Alaska before the airplane. They delivered mail with dog teams. They delivered serum to Nome from Fairbanks when Nome was in 1925 in the throes of a diphtheria epidemic. Even after the airplane came, dog teams delivered mail. It became more of a thing of the past as the airplane became more acceptable. But dog teams have always been a thing in Alaska to the Alaska Native people. They had dogs before the Europeans came. My liking or my wanting to be involved in dogs after I saw the first Iditarod busher come into Nome, I had heard about them when I was the officer in Bristol Bay, but when I saw those first that first team, it was the second year of the running, I think.
Of the Iditarod.
Yes, and I thought to myself, I want to do this.
And the Iditarod is a race from...
Yeah, it's over, it's about, they say 1,049, but it's 1,100 to 1,200 mile race from Anchorage to Nome on dog team. And it commemorates the all of this historical business I'm talking about. And, of course, Nome was the original place where dog racing all started with dog teams clear back in 1908 when people had to, they were doing spring races to kind of break the doldrums of all that horrible long winter. And so they had dog races with their male teams. And the first races and the first rules were born in Nome in 1908, and between then and 1920, there were big pots of money made by in the gold fields and in those areas in Nome on racing dogs, and so there was a lot of history connected to that. And in fact, Nome just now celebrated its 100-year centennial on the All-Alaska Sweepstakes, which was a race connected to those first races. So I wanted to do the Iditarod, and so I got a dog team. And the dogs that I chose were dogs that came from Eskimo villages and Indian villagers.
Oh, really?
So that contact and being interested when I would land and to do my work as a fish and wildlife officer, a special agent, and then going and checking out somebody's dogs was like, hey, this is this end of it, and now this is the other end of it. And people were really, I think, they were really infatuated by that kind of a person.
And did you ever run that race?
Well, eventually I did run the race and did fairly well in the race and got involved in the race as in the early days when it was just getting, it had growing pains from the Nomad. And so I was training for that race all night and then come back to do my job all day. And
what was it like to run that race? It's run at what time of year?
It's run in the March. It's from on the first Saturday of March, and in those days it took 30 days. Then during the time I raced it in 1977, it took 16 days, and now it's down to 10 days.
And what does it take to run it?
Well, if I don't know other than to say this, that I would put... It's a little like a religious experience, and you have to have your eye single to one thing, and that's being on the trail, being prepared, and being ready for anything, all the way from 60 below zero to rain, and being able to stand there and or to push or to crawl through the snow or from anything from whiteout blizzards to a hot 40-degree day, and to have the mental stamina and determination to see your way through all of those miles.
How did it change you?
You think to yourself that if you could do this, you could do anything.
And I have to say, it seems you can do anything. In addition to being the first Fish and Wildlife Service special agent posted in Northwest Alaska, you also broke new ground in working with the Russians. Can you tell me about that?
Well, just as the Iron Curtain, or the Ice Curtain, we call it on the Alaska side, was lowered, I was the first agent and the first fish and wildlife person to go across on Uncle Sam's dime to meet my counterpart.
And when was that you
went? It was in the early 90s.
And what did you learn?
They had the same thoughts about us while we were having the same thoughts about them. And one of the most interesting experiences I ever had was standing with some folks in a cabin in a toast. I was using water, they were using vodka, and some other Russians using water and a toast in the cabin to our friendship and talking about the fact that, hey, we are alike, and we hope that we can have much more of this camaraderie. And in those days, of course, they were screaming for contact with outside of their culture that they'd been in for those 70 years. But
and that really set a stage for working together with.
Oh yes, it did, and there of course those first trips have developed into a into a thing that Fish and Wildlife Service does worldwide now and sends agents all over to teach and to not fraternize, but to assist with investigations and with other wildlife agencies throughout the world. And I came back from there so taken with what I'd seen that I created a fund called the Russian Wildlife Protection Assistance Fund. And we did several years of sending money and uniforms and different gifts type stuff to wildlife people to help assist them in their jobs. And it wasn't until things began to change again in Russia where it became more difficult that I dissolved it. But it was a little like World Wildlife was doing, only we were trying to send everything to the local level instead of filter it through Moscow. And you know what happens when things get filtered from the top? A lot of it doesn't reach the bottom. Or something, have a background of some degree of what you're going to be doing so that you would have an understanding of why those laws were written and you would have an interest in the outdoors. And then start out at the bottom. And it's unfortunate that there's only 200 and some odd agents in the country. That may be why we call them special. I'm just making a joke, but there are lots and lots of competition. But if you land the job and you do it good and you get in the right place, it's, well, I look at it, like I say, my job was an adventure of a lifetime. I got up every day and went to bed every night, thrilled that I had the job and that I was seen and doing the things that I loved.
And making a huge difference while doing it.
Well, I hope so.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me. I really appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome.
I hope you enjoyed those insights into wildlife law enforcement in Alaska with Al Crane, a retired Fish and Wildlife Service special agent and pilot. Now, let me replay you creature call number 2 from the wildlife's creature call contest. This animal is a pinniped with external ear flaps. You often see this animal showing off its natural behaviors in shows at zoos, aquariums, and circuses. Here's creature call number 2. To enter the creature call contest, you can email me your guesses of the 10 sounds anytime before 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Monday, February 15th, 2010. You can send your email to me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. That's laurel@laurelnemi, that's laurel, N as in Nancy, E, M as in Mary, E.com. For detailed hints on all 10 animal sounds in the Creature Call Contest, you can listen to the January 18th episode of The Wildlife via podcast. You can find this and other archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can also stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. You can also join me next week as I talk with wildlife biologist and author Susan Jewell, who is an Indiana Jane of the wild world. Listen as she tells me about her adventure studying wildlife from Maine to Florida by motorboat, airboat, canoe, airplane, helicopter, tree climbing, scuba diving, and muddy feet. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.